I hope you enjoy this talk. These talks are always offered freely so that no one is ever denied access to them. And your support, or dana, also makes a big difference. Dana is the ancient Pali word for spontaneous generosity of heart. If you feel inspired to support these talks by offering dana, you can do so by visiting my website at www.mindfulvalley.com. Thank you so much.
As promised, tonight I'm going to talk about Kalyana Mitra. I love that word, just to say it. And I want to start with a story from the Pali Canon that I like that comes from the Magaya Sutra. And Magaya is actually the name of this young novice monk who's the focus of the story. And so as a novice monk, he was one of the Buddha's attendants and had traveled with the Buddha and his Sangha to this small village in the mountains. And one day, after this monk had gone down into the village on his alms rounds, he had went down there alone, he decided on the way back to take this long walk along the river. And as he was walking along the river, he discovered this incredibly peaceful-looking mango grove there. And so as soon as he got back to the Buddha, he knelt down next to him, as he was supposed to, as one of his attendants. And he told him sort of excitedly that he'd found this really beautiful mango grove down in the village and begged him, "Can I please go down there and meditate alone instead of staying here with the Sangha and the rest of the monks and nuns and with you?" And instead of answering him, the Buddha said, "As long as I'm still alone, please stay here until another monk comes," okay, because he was attending him. But this young monk really wanted to go to that mango grove and meditate by himself. And he just thought it was the best place that for him, the place, if he could meditate alone, he would just achieve a higher learning and wisdom. And he just thought that was the best place to go. He was really excited about it. So a second time he asked, "Lord, the Blessed One clearly has nothing further to do and nothing further to add to what he has done. I, however, have something further to do and something further to add to what I have done. If the Blessed One gives me permission, I would like to go to the mango grove to exert myself in meditation." And again, the Buddha said, "As long as I'm still alone, please stay here until another monk comes." But you might imagine this young monk as a teenager here, right? He said again, "Lord, the Blessed One clearly has nothing further to do," etc. And so finally the Buddha said, "As you were talking about exertion, Megiga, what can we say? Do what you think it is now time to do." So Buddha just gave in. "Go for it. Go ahead." And so feeling, you know, really thrilled about this, this young monk left the Sangha and he went out to this really peaceful looking mango grove all by himself to meditate. Except really quickly, almost immediately, to his shock and dismay, instead of this being peaceful in any way, this young monk found that his mind was filled with malicious, lustful, and confused thoughts, according to the sutta. So he didn't last long at all. And that evening, he rushed back to report his experience to the Buddha, who, of course, wasn't surprised. And he said, "Mahiga, when your mindfulness is not fully refined, still immature, there are five qualities that develop full maturity and the cessation of troubling qualities of mind. The very first quality to develop are skillful and honorable friends and associations. Avoid unskillful, distracting, and troubling associations." That was his first advice. He said the other four qualities are virtuous conduct, speech that doesn't promote the ego or the self, the energy and effort for abandoning unwholesome qualities, And finally, insight into impermanence, anicca. And to really take this point home, the Buddha went through this whole list again, but this time he added before each of these the words, when one has skillful and honorable people as friends and association, it is to be expected that one will achieve virtuous conduct. When one has skillful and honorable friends and associations, it is to be expected that one will have speech that doesn't promote the ego or the self, will develop the energy and effort for abandoning unwholesome qualities and developing wholesome ones, and finally, insight into impermanence. So we added that has skillful and honorable people as friends and associations to each one of these things. That was first. In another very famous passage, some of you may have heard this one, because it's very famous. The Buddha was sitting next to his cousin Ananda, who said to him, Lord, this is half of the holy life, admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie. And the Buddha said, no, don't say that, Ananda, don't say that. Admirable friendship, admirable companionship, admirable camaraderie is actually the whole. It's the whole of this holy life. When a monk has admirable people as friends, companions, and colleagues, he can be expected to develop and pursue the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay. So in another sutta, the Buddha went on to declare, with regard to external factors, I don't envision any other single factor like admirable friendship as doing so much for a monk in training. That's pretty powerful right there. So the idea here is that as much as we'd like to believe, we really can't do this alone. We can't do it alone. You know, maybe mainly because we aren't ever alone, truly. You know, we are all truly interconnected or interdependent on one another. We really are. And so because of this, it's important for us as part of our practice to seek out others who are going to help us along in our spiritual development, right? And so in the suttas and the teachings, the Buddha actually urges us to do this, to seek out those who are going to be a good influence on us rather than a bad influence on us, to really be conscious about it and seek out those who are going to help us. And to recognize and actually question our affiliation with those who might be a bad influence, right? To, quote, avoid unskillful, distracting, troubling associations. Okay? So in other words, just as we use our formal practice to investigate the nature of our minds and discover what thoughts lead to happiness and what thoughts lead us to more suffering or unskillful actions, we also want to be aware of the relationships that we have in our lives and which relationships, to be honest, to question these, which relationships might lead to more happiness and which ones might or may be leading to more suffering or maybe more unskillful actions. Now we have that friend that's a bad influence, maybe. So again, just as in the practice, we seek to nurture those thoughts that are considered wholesome or skillful in the practice, that foster the good in us. We also want to seek out those people who are going to help us along the path of nurturing what is wholesome and skillful and good in us. These are the same people who are going to be able to help us to abandon those traits that are unwholesome or unskillful or harmful to both ourselves and others. No. These are the people that are going to challenge us in some way, actually, like a good parent would, right? They're going to be loving, but they're also going to be a little challenging. So the hope is that they're going to help us to mature and build up the traits of kindness, compassion, joy, and peace, you know, rather than their opposites. In the Dhammapada, there's a passage that I think about often, which is, a head of gray hairs does not mean that one is an elder. Advanced in years, one is called an old fool. But one in whom there is truth, restraint, rectitude, gentleness, self-control, this one is called an elder. Right? Another passage that I love from the Dhammapada tells us, it is good to see noble ones, happy in their company always. Through not seeing fools constantly, one would be happy. Isn't that good? For living with a fool, one grieves a long time. Painful is communion with fools as with an enemy always. Happy is communion with the enlightened as with a gathering of kin. So the enlightened one, discerning, learned, enduring, dutiful, noble, intelligent, one of integrity, follow that one of this sort, as the moon, the path of the zodiac stars. Okay. So the Pali word for this kind of friend or association, or gathering of kin, if you will, is Kalyana Mitra, spiritual friends, noble friends. And Kalyana in Pali means lovely or beautiful, and Mitta means friend. So Kalyana Mitra is often translated as association or affiliation with the lovely, which sounds a little British to me. But that's really how it translates, association with the lovely. I can't do the accent, but you can imagine. So traditionally, Kalyana Mitra means the people in your Sangha, right here, all these people here, as well as your teacher. And those on the path often call themselves, I do this with my Sangha in DC, we call each other Dharma brothers and sisters, kin, okay, spiritual kin. And since we are not monks and nuns living in a monastery together, our spiritual lives and our daily lives are not disconnected, right? They're the same. So Kalyana Mitra then includes all those people that we surround ourselves. It includes that. And so you might recall a very common saying that tells us that we are who we surround ourselves with. We are who we surround ourselves with. A more recent one that I heard that I really like and I think is true is that we are the average of the five people we spend the most time with. We are the average of the five people we spend the most time with. So for instance, if almost all of your closest friends are crooks and have maybe been arrested and charged as crooks, guess what? Chances are, I'm just saying. So, you know, just think about this for a minute. Who are the five people you spend the most time with? Really think about it. And I can't remember who said it, but I really resonated with this phrase that I once heard, which is, if you look at the people in your circle and you don't get inspired, then you don't have a circle, you have a cage. Yeah. So in the teachings, there are so many ways that we are actually strongly discouraged from hanging out with or following those who are toxic or vexatious to the mind and heart and spirit. Again, from the Dhammapada, the Buddha tells us, delight in vigilance, protect your own mind, lift yourself from a bad course like a tusker or elephant sunk in the mud. If you find an intelligent companion, a fellow traveler, a sage of good conduct, you should travel together, delighted and mindful, overcoming all dangers. If you do not find an intelligent companion, a fellow traveler of good conduct, and wise, travel alone. There is no companionship with a fool. It is better to go alone. Travel alone, at ease, doing no evil. On the other hand, in the Mitta Sutra, the Discourse on Friends, the Buddha asks us to seek out friends with these seven qualities. Okay? This person gives what is hard to give. They do what is hard to do. They endure what is hard to endure. They reveal their secrets to you, and they keep your secrets. When misfortune strikes, they do not abandon you. And when you're down and out, they don't look down on you. So the Buddha tells us a friend endowed with these seven qualities is worth associating with. So I thought it might be interesting as a comparison to look at the opposite of this. Okay? It might look like a person gives what is easy to give. It's the opposite. They do what's easy to do. They endure what's easy to endure. They do not reveal their secrets to you. They do not keep your secrets. When misfortune strikes, they abandon you. When you're down and out, they look down on you. A friend endowed with these seven qualities is not worth associating with. That would be the opposite. So those are the seven qualities to look out for. And the Buddha also helps us out in another way, which is by describing four different types of friends that we should recognize. Okay, four different types of friends. And once we recognize them, we are then urged to consciously nurture our relationship with these. Seek them out and nurture these relationships. And the four are the helper, the friend who endures in good times and bad, the mentor, and the compassionate friend, these four. And of course, sometimes one person can be a few or even all of these, right? And so what I'd like to do is invite you just right now into a short contemplation. And I'm going to read these descriptions to you, these types of friends, okay? So just go ahead and close the eyes as you're ready. And just settle for a moment. You can even just take a nice deep breath in and out. And if you'd like to, as always, you can just place a hand on the heart, hand on the belly, whatever you'd like, or not. It's your choice. And as I'm reading these, you might consider two things, which is there anyone in my life who resembles this person? Might think of those five people again, maybe. Is there anyone in my life who resembles this person? And the second question is, could I be one or more of these to somebody else? Those are the two things to kind of contemplate, keep in mind. And these four types of friends are taken from the Sigalavada Sutra. And what I love to remember about this is that this was written thousands of years ago, and it still really rings true today, as do all the teachings. I'll read these. The first one is the helper. And there's four qualities to each of these four. The helper protects you when you're vulnerable and likewise protects your wealth. Is a refuge when you are afraid. And in various tasks provides double what is requested. I'll read that again. The helper protects you when you're vulnerable and likewise protects your wealth, is a refuge when you're afraid, and in various tasks provides double what is requested. And think about someone in your life who might be a helper, or if you are a helper to someone. And the second kind of friend is an enduring friend. This friend tells you their secrets, guards your secrets closely, does not abandon you in misfortune, and might even die for you. The enduring friend tells you their secrets and guards yours, doesn't abandon you in misfortune, and might even die for you. The mentor, the third type of friend, restrains you from wrongdoing, guides you towards good actions, tells you what you ought to know, and shows you the path to enlightenment, if you will. Shows you the path. The mentor restrains you from wrongdoing, guides you towards good actions, tells you what you ought to know, and shows you the path. The compassionate friend is the fourth kind of friend. This friend does not rejoice in your misfortune, delights in your good fortune, prevents others from speaking ill of you, and encourages others who praise your good qualities. The compassionate friend does not rejoice in your misfortune, but delights in your good fortune, prevents others from speaking ill of you, and encourages others who praise your good qualities. And as the Buddha suggested, our practice of Dharma itself is in essence a relational activity, since again, we don't live in isolation even from ourselves. We don't live in isolation from ourselves. So we really like this question from the teacher Oren J. Sofer, who writes, "The question we examine again and again on this path is, what qualities of heart and mind constitute that relationship?" So just consider, is it characterized by confusion, craving, fear, manipulation, or hostility? Or is it characterized by the clarity of wisdom, the brightness of generosity, and the warmth of compassion? So just for a moment, I want to invite you to reflect on those people that you've surrounded with and ask yourself that same question. What qualities of heart-mind constitute that relationship? Is it characterized by confusion, craving, fear, manipulation, hostility? Or is it characterized by the clarity of wisdom, the brightness of generosity, the warmth of compassion? And of course, with our practice, we're not only looking at our outside relationships, but our inner one, how we're relating to ourselves, to our own mind and heart. So consider your relationship to yourself. Ask yourself that same question. What qualities of heart-mind constitute that relationship? Is it characterized by confusion, craving, fear, manipulation, hostility? Or by the clarity of wisdom, generosity, compassion? So you can go ahead and open your eyes whenever you're ready. So I know that was a short meditation, but I want you to keep that in mind as something to contemplate maybe this week as you go along. And again, in all of these relationships, including the one with ourself, we're being asked to engage in a way that is going to help us to nurture the qualities of friendliness, kindness, compassion, forgiveness, joy, and peace, and abandon those qualities that reflect the opposite of these. And of course, just to say, we all need to remember that these are ideals, right? None of us are perfect. None of us, not a single one of us, which is why, because we're imperfect, we need one another, right? So that we can either mirror these qualities for others or learn to develop them as we're relating to ourselves and others. That's why we're here. There's a great story that I love that comes from Ajahn Amaro, who writes about his teacher, who's the great Ajahn Chah, who's my teacher's teacher, Ajahn Chah. And Ajahn Amaro said that in his early days, Ajahn Chah frequently would leave the monastery to go meditate by himself. Okay, he would just leave his own monastery because he had to get out of there. And so Ajahn Amaro said of this, he had found that he could develop profound concentration and insight and experience some interesting mind states when he went off to the hills alone. But then when he would come back and stay with the other monks, he could only cope for a little while. He would begin to lose his temper and get upset, angry, and annoyed about how incompetent and useless everybody else was. After a few years of this, he realized that he had some lessons to learn. Quote, "Well, it's easy for me to go and be alone and be the fierce ascetic off in the forest. What is difficult is to be with other people, to learn how to spend time with others." And so he began to put himself in that position more and more, and eventually he developed all his monasteries in that style. And in the end, Ajahn Chah established more monasteries than any meditation teacher in Thailand, about 140. And this is the tradition that I was raised in. So Ajahn Amaro wrote, "From an idealistic position, one could say, it's better to do it on your own. That's the way to be strong. But for most of us, it's very easy to be fooled, to follow our own desires and fears and be dishonest with ourselves. Living amongst like-minded people provides a great mirror to see our own preferences, our own fears, our own shortcomings." Okay. And here, I hope that you will notice the phrase, like-minded people. These are our Kalyala Mitra, our spiritual friends, our gathering of kin on the path with us, who are all imperfect, as we all are, but we all have the same intention, right? And that is crucial. That part is crucial. If our intention is to be kind and compassionate and forgiving and truthful in our relationships, including our relationship with ourselves. That is where we grow. That is where we transform. It's all hooked on intention. The Zen priest Norman Fisher suggested that both Emerson and the Buddha believed that spiritual friendship requires two elements, two things, truth and tenderness. Truth and tenderness. He writes, spiritual friends are honest with one another. They have courage. They take risks. And they speak from the standpoint of truthfulness, not expediency. When my friends go astray, at least as far as I can see, I must speak up. And I expect the same from them as well. Yet tenderness is equally important. Dogen writes of the power of kind speech. Speak to sentient beings as you would to a baby. Speak with that much tender love and sweetness. I can receive a true friend's criticism with loving kindness because it comes from a loving heart seeking only my benefit and well-being. And if I find I am lacking in tenderness, speaking what I consider to be truth out of defensiveness or separateness, I have to discern this. I have to work on healing the causes within myself of this breach of kindness. I need to keep my peace until I am ready to speak with love. So, just a curiosity, how many of you are in a Kalyana Mitra or a KM group, what are called KM groups? Quite a few of you. For those of you who don't know what that is, these are traditional Vipassana insight meditation groups, usually about 8 to 10 Sangha members, and they get together monthly at someone's home usually, and they meditate together for a little while, and then they do a go-around, they pass the stick and each person shares, and then they open it up to discussion about practice. And I think there are 3 or 4 of these now in our own Sangha, which I just love. And they're such a great way to develop this kind of intention of truth and tenderness, you know, being kind and compassionate to one another and helping one another to grow in the practice. And by the way, if you don't have a KM group and you're interested and would like one of these, just let me know and I can put a sign-up sheet out on the flyer table, and these usually fill up pretty quickly, so let me know. That's how the other ones have started. And again, what I really love about these groups is that the members really do end up mirroring for each other those two qualities mentioned by Emerson and the Buddha, just truth and tenderness. I've seen it happen so many times, and it does foster so much more growth in our practice. And again, we're actually doing the same thing here in the larger Sangha, which is why I love that new tradition of the cookies, because it really has brought everybody together, and so everybody just going home and taking off. So I really enjoy that. And at the same time, Kalyana Mitra is really a different type of friendship in those KM groups and in our Sangha. So again, our intention is a bit different. There's support, and there's kindness, and there's a practice of letting go, of not clinging to these relationships, right? I love how Pema Chodron writes about this. She says, the support that we give each other as practitioners is not the usual kind of samsaric support in which we all join the same team and complain about someone else. It's more that you're on your own, completely alone. But it's helpful to know that there are 40 other people who are also going through this all by themselves. That's very supportive and encouraging. Fundamentally, even though other people can give you support, you do it yourself, and that's how you grow up in this process, rather than becoming more dependent. Okay. Tara Brach, one of my main teachers, says this another way. She says, having spiritual friends is not a superficial comfort. It helps free us from the trance of separation so deep that we are often not aware of it. Conscious relationships shine a direct light both on our layered feelings of unworthiness and loneliness and on the truth of our belonging. We begin to respond more compassionately and actively to the suffering of the world. Our real community, we discover, includes all beings. Our real community includes all beings. Okay. As I also mentioned, Kaliyala Mitra also includes your teacher, who is actually supposed to get under your skin sometimes. In fact, much of the time, which might be good to know. And the Dhammapada actually tells us that when a teacher points out a student's faults and tries to correct them, the student should feel as though the teacher were pointing out hidden treasure. So if I haven't really pissed you off at some point in time, I apologize for letting you down. And I hope you'll give me a chance to do this in the future. I'm really serious about that, you know. And if I'm good at it, says Kathy, who gives me the bird quite a lot, which is always a good sign. Honestly. I also want to mention that Kaliyala Mitra does not always mean a person, which is interesting. That's a whole other topic. But Kaliyala Mitra can be anything that shakes us out of our trance of ego and helps us to grow and to transform, okay, if we let it. So, for instance, they say that illness can be Kaliyala Mitra, right? The death of a dear one can be Kaliyala Mitra. The birth of a child, right? Falling in love can also be Kaliyala Mitra. Changes everything, right? And we also need to remember that Kaliyala Mitra means friend. So we need to especially welcome those painful experiences with kindness, right? Again, they're here to teach us something if we don't push them away. We welcome them, we bow to them. The Zen Roshi Wendy Egyoko Nikayo, she writes, "It may be difficult to regard a painful experience as a friend. We respond by pushing such experiences away or by grasping on to something else. But in meditation, we learn to sit in the midst of our suffering, much as one would do with someone in need. Just sitting, just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching awareness, recognizing and affirming the most essential nature of our situation, whatever it may be." That's how we practice with painful experiences. In some Buddhist texts, it is said that the Buddha or a teacher may appear like a stone or a dog or a beggar, so on, as objects, and that we should always be alert to their teachings, the teachings that might come from ordinary beings or objects, which I find interesting. I've also been taught that the most difficult people in our lives actually are little Buddhas, right? They're little Kaliyala Mitra in disguise, and we're asked to bow to these people and to say thank you for the opportunity to grow. So think of all those difficult people in your life, right? Can you think of them as Kaliyala Mitra? Thank you. Thank you for helping me to grow and have patience and tolerance, you know? And again, whenever we're doing this, it's important to have an intention around it. So, you know, some of the phrases that I've learned for this are, "May this suffering serve awakening." That's a classic one. You know, whenever we have a painful experience, "May this suffering serve awakening." Or, "May this suffering awaken compassion." That's always a beautiful one to use. "May it awaken compassion to me." And I might add one more, which might be an intention you can use with your spiritual friends, which is, "May this relationship serve awakening. May this relationship serve in some way my awakening or the other person's awakening. Okay. So I think I'm going to end there. I've got about 5 minutes left and invite you into one final quick contemplation. So if you'd like to just come into a nice seated posture. And just taking a nice deep breath in and out, settling. And again, you might even place your hand on the heart or the belly. And considering your relationship with yourself again, I'm going to invite you to consider what type of friend you are to yourself. Okay. So I'll read those again. Just contemplate. The helper. How are you a helper to yourself? In what way? A helper protects you when you're vulnerable, protects your wealth, is a refuge when you're afraid, and in various tasks provides double what is requested. How are you a helper to yourself? And if you find that you're not a helper to yourself, how might you like to be a helper? What could you change? What about the enduring friend? Are you an enduring friend to yourself? The enduring friend tells you your secrets, tells you their secrets, guards your secrets, does not abandon you in misfortune, and even might die for you. Are you an enduring friend for yourself? What about a mentor? In what way are you a mentor to yourself? Mentor restrains you from wrongdoing. Guides you towards good actions. Tells you what you ought to know. And shows you the path to enlightenment. What part of you is a mentor? What about the compassionate friend? Are you a compassionate friend to yourself? The compassionate friend does not rejoice in your misfortune, but delights and your good fortune. Prevents others from speaking ill of you. And encourages praise for your good qualities. Just reflect on those qualities for a moment and might notice what is there and have gratitude for that. And if something seems to be lacking, you might consider how you'd like to be a better friend to yourself. Is there any way you could be a better friend to yourself? Make that intention. As we offer this to ourselves, it's much easier for us to then offer that same kind of friendship out. And so I'll end with these words from Mark Nepo, who writes, "I've come to believe that we were all broken from the same nameless heart. And every living thing wakes with a piece of that original heart aching its way into being. Along the way, we are broken open like seeds that bear fruit, so we can meet each other and be touched by each other, so we can remember and inhabit the one precious life we're given. And when broken of all that gets in the way, we suddenly know each other below our strangeness. This is why when we fall, we lift each other. Or when in pain, we hold each other. Why when suddenly with joy, we dance together. Life is the many pieces of that great heart loving itself back together."